You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Tuesday, 18 March. Today in 1974, the seven member countries of OPEC lifted a five-month oil embargo against the United States. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Komala Mopoane, MTN results, lots of constant currency adjustments, spinning off some fintech and the like. Messi, get thoughts from her around the business. Brett McKay from 10X Investments, pros and cons, differences of living and guaranteed annuities. Is there a space perhaps for a bit of both? And then Naveen Lala, he has some Old Mutual Alternative Investments. Private markets as part of a 60-40 portfolio split. Is that 60-40? Well, it's becoming overly correlated and not quite doing what it's meant to be. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines from MoneyWeb. Where was the two-pot money spent? Debt and education sounded like a good idea and certainly was in the exit surveys, but it seems not to have gone there. Business Day, lower inflation expectations for 2025, but growth concerns persist. The Bureau of Economic Research survey expects average salaries and wages to rise 4.5% this year. Morning markets, US was green, S&P and NASDAQ both 0.6% higher. The East is mostly green, Sydney's the red, down 0.6%. Tokyo up 1.5%, Hong Kong and Tencent both 2% higher. Commodities, green across the board. Gold futures, $3,022. Brent, oil, $71.26. Platinum, $1,031. Palladium, $978. The Rand is 18.11. Bitcoin, $83,100. Top 40 opening call, green open, 140 points or a little under 0.2% higher.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Komala Mopoane. Komala, appreciate the early morning time. MTN results, I mean, we know what's been happening with a number of the currencies, most notably the Naira in Nigeria, seems to have stabilized. But this was a tough reporting period for them. As I said, there's constant mentions of constant currencies. That certainly is the big woes. They managed to push the dividend up, but headline earnings almost 70% lower. Your take on the numbers from MTN and particularly the currency risks?
Yeah, it's probably one of the themes we've seen over the last few years for MTN, unfortunately. And as you said, largely due to the Naira's devaluation. So I think because of that, and you know, the market monitors the Naira specifically in regards to MTN, that share price did not go down. It was expected. Mm-hmm. So in fact, went up by 1.56% by end of the day. But I think that was buoyed by the surprise to the upside for the dividend that was declared by the board. So I think the focus there is to actually wade through the currency impact and obviously the impairment in terms of Sudan as well. Mm. But having said that, if you look at top lines, it remains to be strong. Still continue to see movement away from voice and more to data as expected. Mm-hmm. Subscribers have been strong. So the fundamentals seem to be there, but unfortunately Nigeria is just so big in MTN's life that it has such a severe impact on the numbers.
In part, though, I mean, and management state this, and certainly if I look at a Naira US dollar chart, and to your point, I think it's a chart no one had looked at 2 years ago, and suddenly it's on our screens all the time. If the worst of the Naira is behind them, I mean, they've essentially reset at this base and can look forward to potentially growing profitability post period, and they did get that authority to increase fees by up to 50%. They say they won't go that far, but does it put them in a stronger footing if the Naira remains stable?
I think management has definitely moved to being more proactive. We have seen them trying different levers in Nigeria, as you've said. Mm-hmm. But it remains to be seen what actually occurs. You know, is the stability of the Naira likely to be maintained? In the broader scheme, I'm really not sure what's happening in the rest of the world. And so that obviously has an impact on Africa and Nigeria as well. So it's so difficult to determine right now. But I think that the market has shown that, look, we understand. we recognize the risks and we've taken them into the share price.
A quick last one. Mobile money users only up just under 1%, but of course transaction volumes up over 15%. They need to separate three of the units, Ghana, Nigeria, Uganda. This is a deal with MasterCard. Is that I don't know, is fintech within MTN sort of, I don't want to say it's savior, but going to be a huge winner for them?
So that was definitely the key. I think about 3-4 years ago was the focus on fintech and the big springboard that was going to come from it. I think my concern always has been that in those geographical locations, there are bigger players who are already entrenched in the market. So you're already a foreigner coming in, trying to gain traction, and you know the market, the person on the ground already has who they're comfortable with. So it's really the question of, we've given it 3-4 years. Yes, there's still big growth, but it's off a very, very low base. How far can this actually go? I don't say they should look away from it, but I think it's a really hard road to take for them.
Yeah, no, I take your point in it. It's there are the incumbents already in place and 100 other new ones coming at the same time. We'll leave it there. Kamla Meprawani, appreciate the early morning time. That's our poll today, LinkedIn and Twitter. Is MTN a stock to hold? It's had a rough time. I mean, zoom out to that 10-year chart. It's a bit of an ouch, but have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. Give your money the return at once without taking a flight with the StanLib Global Select Fund, an offshore equity fund submanaged by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
I'm chatting with Brett McKay, investment consultant and group RA manager at 10X Investments. Brett, appreciate the time. I want to talk annuities before we get into them. From a practical perspective, at retirement, my Reg 28, a third of it I can take cash, two-thirds of it by law, by legislation, I need to buy an annuity or two or more if need be. I've got no avoiding that.
Hi, Simon. Yes, that's correct. So at age 55, you're able to take one-third of your retirement savings in your bank account, obviously subject to tax. The first 550,000 Rand of that is tax-free. And then with the remaining two-thirds, yes, you have to buy an annuity. Now, these are two types of annuities you can buy. You can get a guaranteed annuity, you can get a living annuity, and you can actually do a combination of the two, which is what we call a hybrid annuity.
Yeah, the combination I want to get in a bit. Let's start with the guaranteed or life annuity. This is essentially an insurance product. I give the insurer a pile of money and they promise me for the rest of my life, although it can be mine and my partner's life, as I understand, they will pay me money and it may or may not be inflation adjusted.
Correct. One of the biggest benefits of the guaranteed annuity is getting that secure income for life. It's done through guaranteed fixed payments. And yeah, it is generally offered by insurance companies. The nice thing about this is living annuity or guaranteed annuity investors don't have to worry about the markets and the market fluctuations. However, it does have its drawbacks. So for example, it might not keep up with inflation, although you can add an inflation benefit. And if the investor was to pass away, the capital goes to the insurance company, leaving the loved ones with no benefit. You can add a spousal benefit, however, but the same thing will happen to them in terms of the capital going back to the insurance company.
Yeah, and that is obviously always the key point with insurance. If you never claim, or if you live forever in this case, you're winning, but if you pass in a week or so, you're absolutely not. And part of the thing is with inflation is that, I mean, I'm not yet at retirement age, but from chatting to retirees, medical inflation is perhaps their big pain point, and their annuities are struggling, or their life annuities are struggling with it.
Correct, correct. I mean, we all know inflation is one thing, but personal inflation is completely different things. So, yeah.
The living annuity, a lot more flexibility. This, in essence, you're taking your cash as I get it, and you are getting an investment product that you can then draw out of as and when you need.
Yeah, 100% correct. So it's more flexible in the sense that you can make changes to your draw amounts on an annual basis. You can change the income frequency. So if you don't want to take your income on a monthly basis, you can set it up biannually or annually or quarterly. And you can also change portfolios. So you've got options in terms of asset allocation. It gives you that little bit of flexibility just in terms of being able to adjust what you want in terms of your goals for the specific asset classes that you're in.
In terms of the asset classes, I mean, I imagine then, I mean, I can split between bonds and equities, cash. I can also, I imagine, split local and offshore.
Yeah, 100%. So as you mentioned earlier, a living annuity is not Regulation 28 compliant, meaning you can go 100% offshore if you would really like to.
And your income that you take from that, this is an investment. Your income is therefore taxable at whatever your tax rate happens to be.
Correct. So you'll take an income on an annual basis and you'll be taxed at your marginal income tax rate.
You mentioned, or I said, that you can take what you want. Truthfully, there are minimums and maximums in terms of how much I can draw at any one point or any year from the annuity.
Yes, quite right. So the minimum you are forced to take is 2.5% per annum. The maximum is 17.5%. So generally, we suggest, just in terms of the sustainable sweet spot, because you obviously want to ensure that your lump sum lasts as long as possible. Mm-hmm. We're looking at a 4 to 6% drawdown, just in terms of sustainability sweet spot. The closer to 2.5%, the better. But obviously, everyone has, you know, different income requirements.
Yeah, and it depends what that size of cash is. The main benefit and the main con is that you're exposed to the market. Now, we've had two brilliant years of offshore markets, but we also, the year before that, was the bear market. It is that market exposure which you need to manage as well.
Quite right. And I think one of the biggest misconceptions about a living annuity is when you get to retirement, I think retirees want to immediately go conservative and park their funds into, you know, bonds and cash, when they've actually got another 20, 30, maybe even longer time horizon.
Yeah.
It's very important to make sure that, yes, there will be the volatile periods, the short-term volatile periods, but the end goal is essentially to grow the capital and to beat inflation. And we know that in terms of over time, you want to have that equity exposure, maybe a mix between local and offshore, but you definitely want to make sure that you are somewhat aggressive in your approach to grow that capital.
Yeah, that's a great point. We always talk around, you've got sort of what, 40 years to save for retirement. Truthfully, you might also have 40 years in retirement. You can't just go bonds and cash on retirement day. I want to come back to hybrid. You mentioned a blend of both. I mean, I can see the benefit here where you might use a guaranteed product to sort of, I don't know, cover your medical and maybe food and shelter, and you'd lose your living, one that you will draw down as to 2.5% or 17.5% for the other bits and pieces. Would that sort of be the structure that people would look at in a hybrid environment?
Yeah, quite right. I often see investors using the guaranteed annuity portion just to lock in that income for, like you say, medical aids, day-to-day grocery expenses, the usual expenses that you get on a monthly basis, and then maybe use the living annuity portion for other kinds of expenses. So it is quite a nice option to have both.
And something, and I think it was you who mentioned it on a webcast we were on sometime maybe last year, actually about potentially also having a couple of living annuities. It might be the same provider, it might be the same assets, but a bit of flexibility, because at some point, I don't know, at 85 maybe, you could then flip some of that into a guaranteed as well.
Yep, 100%. So with a living annuity, you can have multiple living annuities. What I see clients do is they'll often stagger them into different stages of a guaranteed annuity. So for example, they'll convert one in 10 years time to a guaranteed annuity, and then maybe another 10 or 5 years after that, they'll convert to another one. And that just gives them some more flexibility. Once you go from a living to a guaranteed annuity, that is essentially the end of the road.
Yeah.
So you want to give yourself options. It also avoids having to convert your entire fund to a guaranteed annuity if that's what you'd like to do in, say, late 70s, 80s.
Gotcha. We'll leave it there. It's Britt McKay, investment consultant and group RA manager, 10X Investments. Appreciate the time. The Standard Flexible Income Fund is designed for pre- and post-retirement income and capital preservation needs. Retire without regret with Stanlib Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Checking now with Niven Lala, client director, Old Mutual Alternative Investments. Niven, appreciate the time this morning. 2024, a year of elections across the world. I think the biggest voting year we have ever seen. A lot of incumbents doing poorly. This really is setting us up for sort of different geopolitical environments going forward, and in a sense going to be stress testing our portfolios. We've seen it in the first couple of months already of President Trump's term in the US. It's going to be a real test of our portfolio resilience at this point in time.
Yes, morning, Simon. Absolutely. I think, as you mentioned, last year the main theme was about the year of the election. And, you know, the theme has been anti-incumbency, with many nations voting for change. And I think with that brings about, call it regime change in leadership, the U.S. being a case in point, driving that, being at the forefront of that change, you know, in terms of America First policy, where, You know, we've seen at the start of the year has been phenomenal. I think it's only been with the start of the presidency has been phenomenal. We've been in for, I think, 3 months?
Mm-hmm.
Feels like 3 years already. So, you know, we expected a new sheriff in town, but it sounds like we've had a new sheriff in town every couple of days.
Yeah, and they come and go. And one of the key things, is it fair to say the 60-40 traditional stock bond portfolio has becoming more correlated and as such less diverse? It's perhaps not quite doing what it used to do and needs a tweak. And the tweak would be perhaps some alternative investments brought into that 60-40 process.
That's correct. I think with the policy uncertainty in the US, we've seen a lot of that's culminated in a lot of volatility in markets.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very interesting phenomenon that's been around for ages, and that's this market concentration. So if you look at the US, the S&P 500, for instance, more than a third of it is concentrated in the top 10 stocks or the Mag 7.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, in the JSE, the top 10 account for about 50 to 60% of the index. So what happens is there's a strong beta effect. So when there's uncertainty or nervousness, it results in exacerbated, call it market volatility or elevated market volatility. So asset prices are moving all over the place. And in order to have a portfolio stabilizer, you want to have exposure to asset classes like private markets where the performance of the assets are the valuation and price is determined by the performance of the underlying assets rather than by market sentiment and, to a lesser extent, economic cycles.
In a sense, what we're doing here, as you say, it's lower volatility in the process. That lower volatility, but also folks will say, we like the price discovery of a listed market. Sure, but that does bring the volatility. The lack of liquidity often put against alternative investments actually is a feature rather than a bug. It works in its favor because, as you say, there isn't this wild swings in pricing.
That's correct. So being unlisted or the price discovery based on valuations, which would happen typically biannually or even quarterly, you've got the valuations driven by, call it the cash flows discounted to figure out what is the actual valuation of this company. And there are certain public market factors that are built in for relevance. But you've got this volatility dampening effect, where because the valuations are driven largely by the performance of the asset, operating asset, rather than market sentiment, it makes your portfolio a lot more efficient because it's dampening volatility. You're getting access to more diversification, more sources of return, and typically you're getting exposure to assets which may not necessarily be available in the public domain. A very important asset class.
That's a great point. It's the different availability of different assets. And yes, we've got, even in the US, there's wide markets. The alternatives really do bring a whole different diverse. In South Africa, a lot of it is around renewable energy, but it's wider than just that. And it is stuff that we simply don't find on our local market.
That's correct. South Africa specifically. You know, we've got, if you're looking for liquidity, from a liquidity perspective, I think beyond your top 60 or top 100 shares, the markets, you give up on lots of liquidity. So I think we see liquidity as sort of a safety mechanism that allows us to change gears and move out. But as you mentioned, that's also a double-edged sword where you could be trading at the wrong time and locking in losses.
Mm-hmm.
Where in the private markets, you're locked in for, call it a 10-year horizon.
Yeah.
And it allows you to harvest the returns generated by these businesses. And it also provides you with a lot more flexibility and nimbleness. So, for instance, because you're involved in these companies, say from a private equity perspective, you're involved with the management, you're involved with the business, and from the get-go, There's intentionality and you're very deliberate in driving the unlock in the business, in making it more efficient. Yeah. And in most cases, just trying to make a good company better and more fantastic.
Yeah, man.
And so that you can drive the value. So it's a pure form of, call it, active management.
Yeah, that was the phrase I was looking for. It said active management, which I think is also another feature within the alternative investment space. We'll leave it there. Naveen Lala, he's client director, Old Mutual Alternative Investments. Appreciate the early morning. That's it for today. We were chatting with TransUnion Africa yesterday about the rise and importance of buy now, pay later. Made a really good point about the use of SMEs in the buy now, pay later as well. Asked if you'd used it. The vast majority said, nope, you'd never tried it. Those who had tried it said it was great and worked exactly as advertised. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie Nobuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. The local fiber optic industry.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.